And it might say, I think you've had enough now. Shouldn't you be going and doing something? Exactly me too, because I, with my father.
Yes, that's same with me.
If I was seen to be sitting there doing nothing, yeah, he'd give me something to do.
Same.
So you had to look busy in our house.
Yeah, 100%. Well, you're not a very good driver, and this is a pretty shit bus, and I don't like the way we're doing this, and who said you could do it, and you're never going to be able to get there, and blah, blah, blah.
Even now, with all this experience and all this training, we still do.
Yeah.
No, but that's the point. It's a struggle. It's not easy. I'm just a coach. I can't help it. What can I say? Bloody annoying, aren't I? Shut up, Nikki.
Sometimes I just want to let me be shit at something, Nikki.
All right, be shit at it then.
Hi, Nikki.
Hi, Carrie. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us. Today, I thought it would be good to follow up on our last podcast.
Yeah.
Because at the end, we were talking about the chimp running, screaming around the trees or sitting eating a banana. And you were saying very cogently that at some point when we do make an error, yes?
I was just going to say, for anybody who hasn't listened to the last episode, we probably ought to reference what the chimp is.
Oh, the chimp, a good idea. Yes.
Yes.
So the chimp comes from Professor Steve Peters, who's a wonderful chap from the north of England. He's internationally renowned as a sports psychologist, as well as an NHS psychologist. And he's written a seminal book called The Chimp Paradox, amongst others. And his premise is that we have a chimp in our head that reacts very, very quickly, much quicker than our frontal cortex can react to things, because it's there to preserve our life, basically, and to help us procreate. And it is very easily triggered by pre-existing stuff that's happened to us, you know, years ago, whatever. And it means that our frontal cortex, as in our, he calls it the human, doesn't really get a look in a lot of the time when the chimp is feeling under threat.
Mm.
So something happens that is possibly innocuous. Our chimp goes off around the trees.
Yeah.
And eventually, hopefully, our brain gets a chance to actually kick in our frontal cortex.
Yes.
And to make some sensible decisions. But as he said, very often when the chimp gets its way, we end up having to apologise for something.
Yeah. And so we were talking in the last podcast about times when we were sort of stressed or anxious about things that possibly there wasn't a great deal of stress or that there was no need for the level of stress and anxiety that we felt.
Yes.
And that our chimp was sort of leaping around, screaming and shouting and drawing our attention to its worries and how we managed that. So I just wanted to preempt that because, you know, obviously I'm sure everyone has listened to the last podcast, and if not, why not?
12 times.
But for those that for any reason hadn't or are just joining us for this one, there's a bit of context for that.
Absolutely. Yes. And if you have just joined us, welcome.
Yes. Welcome.
Yes.
So that's what we were talking about last time. Yep. So yeah, carry on, follow on from there.
And just to round off, at the end, you asked me if I managed to do the thing that was worrying me, which was packing for a 2-centre trip. And I said, yes, I did. And I remembered everything and I didn't take anything I didn't need. And you did the same thing for the marathon that you were running, the London Marathon. So we kind of reached the conclusion that the chimp was really good in alerting us, because that meant that we were able to do all the things we needed to do in order to arrive with everything we needed.
Mm.
So it can be very useful as long as it stands down at the right sort of time and doesn't drive us around the bend and send us into RSD or anything else. So that was the background. And at the end, I've got some notes here. At the end last time, you said, of course, we do have the odd occasion where we do still make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when the chimp will say, you know you will have fucked up.
Yes.
Yes. You do know that, don't you?
Yeah.
I told you so.
Yeah.
You never listened to me. So I then said, well, I wonder if that's a chimp or if that's a inner voice, inner critic.
Mm.
And so we thought we'd explore that side of things, because it's something that comes up with, I know, with yours and my clients.
Yes.
A lot, as well as ourselves.
Absolutely. That inner critic, that voice is so prevalent and so destructive in a lot of ways.
Yes. Although a bit like the chimp, it can be useful, but only up to a point.
Yeah. Well, that might be something to unpick.
Mm.
Is it useful? I think the chimp Well, this is my working hypothesis. I might change my mind.
Yes, let's just explore. Yes, by the time you get to the end.
I'm thinking aloud because I wouldn't have thought about it in my head before I've said this.
Of course not.
But I'm thinking aloud that actually I can see the purpose of the chimp. As much as it's a pain in the arse and it causes that stress and anxiety, it does have a purpose, however misguided, which
yes.
is to alert us to possible difficulties or threats.
Yes, absolutely.
The inner critic, what is its purpose?
Well, I've been listening, as ever. I referenced this in the last episode, and I was indeed correct for once. No, I was indeed correct. It was a Mel Robbins podcast, and it was episode 287, the 8th of May, 25, and it was How to Stop Negative Thoughts, and a very long title, but that was the beginning of it. Professor Ethan Cross, with a K, he's written a book called Chatter, and his premise is the inner critic is part of a suite, as in several bits.
Okay.
And it's inner chatter, and it takes different forms. Can I take you through the four forms in case it's interesting?
Yes, go on.
Okay, so with great thanks to Professor Cross and Mel Robbins. Oh, before I start, the inner voice, they've somehow estimated, has 4,000 words a minute.
Bloody hell.
And that's equivalent, according to Mel Robbins and her calculator, of reading the first book in the Harry Potter series in 20 minutes.
Right. So that's a lot.
It's a lot. This is what's going on. And with ADHDers, it's possibly even more.
Yes.
Because we have fast brains and we can process lots of stuff, especially emotional stuff, all at once.
Yes.
Yes. So the reason it's that much, Professor Cross explains, is because we think in sound bites, not sentences or word by word.
Yeah.
So it's clumps of thoughts coming in at once. So if you unpick those...
Concepts, I guess.
Exactly. Yes. Or past experiences, and they all come in all at once as a lump.
Yeah.
But if you break it down, that's the equivalent.
And I guess, yeah, some of them are visual, aren't they?
They are, absolutely.
If I picture a banana, it's quicker than having to explain to somebody what a banana is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Got it.
And also, your amygdala is very good, or your amygdalae are very good at remembering events and emotional stresses
Hello.
And things. And so it's just like this lovely ready menu of options.
Yes.
So the four functions of the silent inner chatter, he calls it, are verbal working memory, which is things like memorizing a phone number or a name or what do I need to shop for, that kind of thing.
Mm.
Incidentally, that's not necessarily something that ADHDs are typically brilliant at.
Mm.
Verbal working memory and visual working memory, not true for everybody, as none of these things is, but that's... Mm. So that's number one. Number two is to simulate and plan, going back to the last. So simulating is in thinking of what might be needed in the future,
mm-hmm.
and so on. And again, that's something that many ADHDers find tricky, to say the least. And it goes back to things like packing, choosing what to take with you for an event.
Mm. Yep, fine. I'm great at that. Brilliant.
Move on. On swiftly. So the third one is to control and motivate ourselves. So self-talk while exercising, like, come on, go on, do another lap, or come on, get off the sofa, go and do it. Which is where we have a thought about the inner critic. We'll come back to that in a sec. And it includes berating, hence the inner critic, okay?
Okay.
It can be something that you can use. You can switch it to being a...
Sorry.
What?
I'm making notes. As you said this.
Yeah.
Because I want to write these down.
Yeah.
And instead of berating, I wrote burrito.
Yes, you could use it to make a burrito.
And now my brain was, and then I realised I was just thinking about burritos and I completely missed the next bit you said after that.
Isn't that so beautifully ADHD? It makes a change for you rather than me.
Yeah, I started thinking, I don't know how to spell berating. So my brain just decided to write burrito and that's where my thought went.
Absolutely.
So, and then it made me laugh.
Well, I think making a burrito probably comes under either number one or two, possibly.
Two, yeah.
So number three,
yes.
the berating side or the control and motivation side can be used to become an inner coach. We can use it as a skill. So switch to harnessing it to be supportive rather than it being this nagging, horrible, bully, pain in the arse, whatever it happens to be.
Yes.
So number four is we use our silent inner chatter to make meaning. And we know about this one, creating a story. So something happens that we don't understand and it goes round and round in our heads and our inner chatter is like, oh, what's this all about? Oh, well, it must be that they don't like me or whatever. Mm. Yeah. That's the only explanation is that they hate me.
Mm.
Nobody likes me, all that kind of stuff. But I mean, it can be used positively. So it's to help us make sense of the world and it helps shape who we are. I've got stories about that and I'm sure you have. So there's all that going on. And I think the gist of it is that it's perfectly normal to have this going on all the time.
Yes.
I think as ADHDs, we might have more.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us have more than wherever these neurotypicals are.
Mm.
But because of the way our mind is structured and the emotional side that we have controlling our actions, or at least a lot of the time, especially when we're young, controlling our actions, because we don't have the frontal cortex at that stage, we use our emotions to get things done. And as we know, when we're not emotionally engaged in something, it's so hard to do.
Yeah.
And those who don't have this wiring don't understand that, and they call it lazy or stupid or procrastination or whatever it happens to be. But it's mostly that it's that feeling.
Yeah.
The unbearable, I mean, literally unbearable sometimes.
Yes, it's physical, isn't it?
It is physical. And if you don't have it, I mean, I'm sure everybody gets things they don't want to do. It's not quite the same. It's that almost,
no.
It's like a ball and chain or wading through the thickest molasses treacle.
It's painful.
It is painful, absolutely physically painful and emotional. So that's the kind of opening shots of this.
Mm.
And I just thought it would be useful to perhaps share something I was literally about an hour ago talking to a client about as an illustration of something. And so it's...
Can I just sort of reflect back on those four things and what you've said? Because I'd not heard of those before.
Mm.
And that was really interesting. So I wrote them down as you were doing them.
With burrito, yeah.
With burritos thrown in for good measure. And it was really interesting because actually, yes, that's a good awareness to have of those sorts of things that we talk about, that our brain chatters about, you know, that verbal working memory. So that's the how we do something that our voice is maybe giving.
It's information.
Oh, phone numbers and things like that.
Yeah, like a shopping list or...
Oh, I've got to remember to do that. Oh, you know,
Yes.
Oh, buying pasta pops into your head or whatever. I got to. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. But it's the verbal side of it that he's talking about. It's not pictures, as you were saying earlier. It's not so much the pictures as the thoughts in words, if you like.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So literally like a list.
So I must remember, or I mustn't forget, whichever. Ideally, I must remember to get X and such. Oh, I must call my mum this afternoon.
Yes. Or, oh shit, I've forgotten to.
Well, then we're going into number three.
Okay. So I've got that one. The simulate and plan.
It's the whole of the last episode.
Yes. I had a thought there about that's where it can tip into catastrophizing.
Yep. Yep.
And how that planning becomes
overwhelmed.
And it stops being helpful. It goes too far, doesn't it?
Yes. Oh, it can. Yes.
It can. And because you are adding into it all these extra scenarios that could happen.
Yes.
And could go wrong. So you add that into it. Okay, I've got that. Control and motivate. That's an interesting one because motivation sort of only really happens once you've started doing something. But I guess it's that motivation to keep going, isn't it?
See, I slightly disagree with you there because
I know we've talked about
we've had this discussion before. See, if I'm sitting on the sofa,
yes,
and some days like this morning, I loved going for my walk, and yesterday,
yeah,
the day before, I really didn't feel like going, and I was saying today, I don't know if I'm going to go for a walk today. And for me, it's quite rare to feel like that, and I just thought, and I knew, okay, so I don't know which number this falls in. But I have this thing where it's a self-respect thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I know if I'm trying to not say should here, would benefit from doing something like exercise or eating the right food or whatever.
Yes.
If I don't do it, then I'm going to feel a lack or a dent in my self-respect and I'm going to feel a bit shitty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my motivation. And that's the little, I wouldn't say it's actually words in my head. It's not a picture, it's a feeling. But the rational manifestation, if you like, is if you don't do this, you're going to feel like shit.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're going to feel more shitty than you do sitting here. So that's the sort of a motivation.
Yes, I
in advance
think it's probably just being picky semantically.
Semantic, I was going to say.
And it's your interpretation. For me, that's not your motivation for doing something may be self-respect, but I think you don't feel motivated. But when I bet once you got up and you started doing your walk, you were like, oh, this is really lovely. I can keep going with this and I'm actually really enjoying it. And I think that's what I mean by motivation only kicking in. The sort of enjoyment and the intrinsic value in that thing drawing you in often only comes once you've started. Before that, you have to rationalize with yourself, which I think is slightly different to motivation. But this is all an aside.
Okay. Well, it isn't. It's part of it, really. For me, I say it isn't. I think it isn't. Without wishing to disagree with you again, I would say what you've described as, and this is semantic, but as we know from NLP, words are important.
Yeah.
For those who are listening who don't know what NLP is, it's what is it? Neuro-linguistic programming. Yes, we've both been trained in it, and I'm just sitting here thinking, what is it? No. And it's because I'm fixated on this word I'm about to give you. I'm offering up this word, and it's momentum.
Okay.
So once you get going and you've got that.
Yes, I think that's true.
You've got the momentum, whereas for me, the motivation is the first thing. And it could be a positive or a negative motivation, like I don't want to feel like shit or I want to feel great.
Yeah, I can see that. I think they're both valid, aren't they?
Yes.
But I think one of them, if I don't feel motivated to do something, I mean, I don't have an inherent draw towards it. If I've got a form to fill in, there's no way on earth that is I'm going to feel motivated to do that.
Ah, but is motivation always positive or can it be negative?
So that's what I'm saying. Mm. I think maybe I'm defining motivation as I want to.
Ah, okay.
And so I don't feel motivated to do it. Yeah, I see what you mean. And then I think about it and think, oh, I feel shit if I don't, or I won't get the job. Yeah. or I'll
go to prison.
Oh. Yes, or I'll be fined £1 million or whatever it is.
Yes.
Will be enough to make me get off my ass. Yeah, I suppose that is motivation.
Okay,
yeah.
So we're into carrot and stick, the pointy stick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's interesting to look through.
Okay.
So back to control and motivate. And then number four, and making meaning and creating stories. Now that can also then be catastrophizing, can't it? That's where that one has the potential to be a negative.
Totally.
And that made me think, when you said our brains do these sort of 4,000 words a minute. And let's be honest, mine also has tunes playing in the background and all sorts of strange noises.
Song words.
So I was thinking, oh, there's these 4,000 words per minute and I am only aware or feel that I listen to the negative ones. So there is a real negative bias, isn't there?
As there is
in so many things.
And it's there to do what?
Yeah, we're really conscious and listen to that voice going, oh, you're shit and that was useless and everybody hates you or whatever it is.
Yes.
Than the bits that are going, yeah, oh, you've really got this. If you do this, I'm not aware of how many times my brain might motivate me to do something by saying, oh, you don't want that £1,000 fine or you'll get that job or whatever it is. But I'm really aware that my brain is critical of me.
Okay. So, or at least part of your brain.
Yes.
You won't be in the least surprised to know that I've been doing a course lately.
Have you? That's out of character.
Have you heard of internal family systems?
I have.
Do you know what it is? Because I didn't. Well,
no, not clearly, not fully.
No. Okay, well, without wishing to go in depth into it, it's kind of relevant here. And I was thinking on my walk that it might be worth bringing up. So I'm going to call it IFS, as the practitioners do. I'm now IFS informed. Okay, so I now have this, along with trauma informed, because I've done this course. And it's nothing to do with your family. Well, it kind of is, but it's not. It's not directly. It's the family is the family of bods that you've got running around in your head. So if you have a traumatic experience as a child, whether it's a one-off, as we've talked about before, so it's a big T trauma or a small T trauma, which is this sort of chronic, horrible, everyday bullying type, whatever it happens to be, or pain or some sort of trauma.
Or as I thought a really good definition of trauma that I heard is anything that your brain can't wrap its head round. It's like brain indigestion.
Yes, yes.
It doesn't have to be something that anybody else would even notice, but to you, you can't process it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so many of us minimize trauma because we think it's not, you know, it's not being in 9/11 or something. Yeah. It's not worthy of being called a trauma, whereas actually it is if it's affecting you.
Yeah.
If it's beyond your resources to deal with, basically.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Mentally.
Which, as a child, you have less resources.
You have very little resources as a child.
Mm.
So each time you have a traumatic experience or a small T trauma build up, your brain, if it can't cope, especially when you're a child, as you've just said, it walls off that part or creates a part of you to deal with that particular set of circumstances. And so we end up with these, what they call orphaned parts. And they're all running around in our heads, in our amygdala, along with the chimp. And they end up feeding into our decisions without us knowing that they're doing it, that they're even there. And so IFS seeks to dig them out and to deal with them. And I need to read my notes again because it's a very recent course. But the gist of it is you have protectors. And like the chimp, they're not necessarily always protecting us. And so you could have a small child, a four-year-old version of yourself, that thinks it's protecting you by keeping you from doing anything. So if we feel blocked to do something, it could be this small child version of ourselves that was specific to a certain set of circumstances or a circumstance that then comes in and influences everything. So all the rest of us living in our head get blocked by this one protector. And the protector sees us as four. They don't realise that we've grown up and we're now whatever age we are. And so it's being forceful with these methods of protection, even though they're not relevant now. And the idea is that you work with, it's a bit confusing, there's all sorts of different names for these things, but we have firefighters that come up and deal with serious problems, but they're all protectors at the end of the day. And there's things called exiles and there's all sorts of things. But the gist of it is that you've got these little members of yourself living inside your head that come up and they feed into your decisions and your reactions without you even knowing they're there. And the idea is that IFS, it digs them all out. So you can begin to see why the inner chatter is sort of linked with all this.
Mm. So I just want to make sure I've understood.
Sure, absolutely.
So those voices that are doing this 1, 2, 3, and 4 may not be, for me, for example, a 54-year-old woman.
Exactly.
It could be a 4-year-old who is trying to create the story.
Yes.
Or it could be 18-year-old me who is planning something or whatever it is. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So your 4-year-old would be overwhelmed by certain things.
Yes.
But actually now, as you were saying, everybody's different. The things that led to your anxiety in the last one were similar to mine, but they weren't the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't running a marathon, but you were packing the night before.
Yes,
And I was packing for 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah. So it's different. I mean, different requirements and so on, but it's different things. And also at different times in your life, they come along and they stick their oar in.
Mm.
So going back to number three.
The control and motivate.
Yes, that's where our good friend, the critical parent, can come in. And that literally can be your parent's voice telling you not to do that. And you can use the critical parent. As I've said before, you can have the nurturing parent and the critical parent. And the nurturing parent can say, there, you've had a very hard day. Just sit down, put your feet up and watch a nice bit of telly. And then the critical parent might come in after a couple of hours and say, okay, bear in mind, it's probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it might say, I think you've had enough now. Shouldn't you be going and doing something? Exactly me too. Because I, with my father.
Yes, that's same with me.
if I was seen to be sitting there doing nothing, he'd give me something to do.
Same.
So you had to look busy in our house.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
I remember when I finished my degree, my art degree, and I was sitting on the sofa 2 weeks after I finished my degree, and I'd been watching cricket all day. And it wasn't the most exciting day. It was a normal sort of crickety day. And my pulse was about 110. I hadn't moved for an hour and a half. Mm. And my pulse was still 110. And I felt I should be doing something. I couldn't relax. I just could not. I was pre-programmed for that by my father and the trauma of my father. Mini trauma.
So then, okay, let's go with that example.
Yeah.
So in that example, you're sitting on the sofa.
Yeah.
And whether or not it's a verbal inner voice, your body is, is stressed and tense. There is an anxiety because on whatever subconscious level, there is a conditioned protector in there of whatever age or a critical parent, whatever, going, you need to get up and do something else. This isn't good enough. Why are you sitting around?
Yes.
Come on, you've been sat there all day feeling guilty. So which one is that? One, two, three, or four?
Three.
Control and motivate.
Berating.
So berating you.
Burrito.
Burrito. Okay, so that's the berating.
Yeah, but it was interesting. There was a distinction that came into my head then, because if I go back to that sofa and I can remember it, I can remember the room, I've got the whole thing in me, I can remember the feeling. And on that occasion, the background was my father, but it wasn't my father's voice at this stage. All through my childhood until I was about, 18 when I went to art college, that was the background of my father, that when he came home, we'd all rush around looking busy, including my mum, would you believe? But my brother and I, especially, because you might get told off, you might get an occasional whack around the head. You know, it wasn't the worst childhood. There were lots of brilliant things about my childhood, but this was a kind of an ongoing feature. And so I didn't want to trigger him and I didn't want to be given something to do. I was trying to relax. My poor little ADHD brain was trying to relax for a little bit after school, after lassoing it for 6 to 8 hours or whatever it was.
Yes.
So when I was sitting on that sofa watching the cricket, the pulse of 100 plus, it wasn't my father's voice. It wasn't strictly the critical parent. It was me. Mm-hmm. Ah, so this may have been Chimp.
Could have been Chimp. Yes.
Isn't it interesting? This is Chimp saying, oh, I just got goose pimples. So it was Chimp. Okay, so this is where the distinction is. For me, that moment was, you need to look after yourself. If you don't do something, there'll be bad repercussions. And it was a physical thing. I could feel myself. I mean, as I say, my pulse was high and I was just aware of it. Mm. Even at the age of 22, I was just sitting there thinking, what is going on? And I just, you know, I just put it down to stress, which it was, of course.
Mm.
But it wasn't just the stress of the preceding 6 months trying to get my degree stuff finished. It was the stress of, you have to be busy.
Mm.
You have to be seen to be busy. So that's the distinction. Mm. So I think that might have been a mix of the two, actually.
That's really interesting. And I think you're right. I think it probably is both. Maybe the chimp. Yeah. Which comes first, the chimp or the child?
Chicken or the egg.
Yeah. But it is, there's that sort of the child you, or the young person you, and your experience of, God, I ought to be busy. I ought to be busy. I ought to be busy. That's been sort of conditioned in you. Mm. And the chimp is sort of keeping you in that high alert state so that you, I suppose, are safe.
That's the idea, is it keeps you safe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Even though it doesn't always.
No.
Yeah. So keeping your pulse at 110 when you're lying on the sofa for an hour or two is not ideal.
No.
So what are your thoughts about all this?
Well, it's really interesting. That's what I love about talking to you, Nikki, because you listen to all these things and bring these to the table. I think you're right. And I've often used the analogy of passengers on the bus with clients when we're talking about negative self-talk.
Mm.
In fact, I had a client today, we were talking about this, and it's sort of, we are the metaphorical bus driver of our own bus. We should be driving it and we should be having that control and steering and deciding where we go and what we do. But unfortunately, along the way, we pick up all these passengers and people who have a lot of negative self-talk or seem to give a lot of airspace to the passengers who go, well, you're not a very good driver, and this is a pretty shit bus, and I don't like the way we're doing this, and who said you could do it, and you're never going to be able to get there, and blah, blah, blah. And they sort of come along. And really, I guess that's what you're saying does happen with this family systems.
Yes.
But it's just defining who those passengers are a bit more clearly, isn't it?
It is. And being aware when they're sticking their oar in.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Noticing those voices and trying to identify whose voices they are, i.e. are they another person who has always said, you know, you are stupid?
Yeah.
Or are they your own voice as a child or somebody else saying, oh gosh, be busy because otherwise dad will be cross with me.
Yep.
No, don't sit still because being still is bad.
Yes. I think a lot of people have that one.
Yeah, I think so.
And it can be useful. It can get stuff done, get shit done, but it's also, it's a bit like the chimp we talked about before. It's just up to a point.
Yes. There's also those voices that come from genuine experience. You know, I can catastrophize, but that's because I've had a catastrophic situation happen to me. So in my experience, catastrophes do happen.
Mm.
So I sometimes go straight to a catastrophe in certain situations. But I think you just said it, it's knowing, that's my catastrophic passenger who has got a very good reason for thinking this. But actually, maybe the answer is to either introduce some new passengers who you can start listening to, who are probably there already, but like we said, with that negative bias, we don't listen to, because we are all going to have had experiences where things went well.
Yes.
You know, we often talk about how our experiences cause trauma because of this negative bias, but we don't think or consciously draw to mind all those triumphs we've had, all those times where we absolutely smashed it, everything went well, we nailed it, or people told us we were great or anything else. Those are never the things that come to mind. So we need to bring those voices maybe out of the shadows a bit and get those passengers up and running.
How do you do that?
I try and rationalise it. So when I have a catastrophic thought, I am getting much better at going, or...
alternatives, yes. What other explanation could there be for this?
There are other alternatives. Yeah. And then I look at likelihood. Actually, the other alternatives are much more likely. Yes, catastrophes happen, but they are rare.
Mm.
And so I can never get rid of the fact that that could happen. But I allow it to coexist with or actually be outnumbered by more realistic scenarios.
Mm. There's also hand in glove with what you've just said is looking at the evidence. What evidence is there to support this story that I'm telling myself here?
Yes, absolutely.
Is it actually true? And on what can I base this?
Yes.
Because if somebody suddenly doesn't return your text and we go into, and we do as ADHDers, we go into RSD about, they hate me and they don't love me and blah, blah, blah. Well, what evidence do we have for that?
Yeah.
What else could they be doing, as you've just said? You know, what are the other explanations? Well, they might be tied up at work. They may have lost their phone. They may have run out of battery. You know, there's millions of different reasons. And what evidence do we have that they do actually like me or love me? You know, the last 20 years. Oh, yeah, that'll be it then.
Yes. I was working with a client recently on how do you know if you can trust people?
Mm.
And it sort of boiled down to what you're saying, evidence of consistency over a period of time.
Mm.
You know, if somebody is consistently there for you over a long period of time and you've got no evidence to suggest that they are doing anything hurtful or harmful or have ulterior motives for doing it, then the chances are you can trust them. Now, of course, people, I mean, I don't want to go down this tangent, but people do that. That's like grooming, you know, works along those lines. Oh, God. So it can go catastrophically wrong. Shit. Shouldn't have started saying this.
I can cut this out.
But there are always going to be exceptions.
Yes.
You know, and I guess it's then what checks and balances. Who could I talk to who also knows about this situation, who can give me a different perspective on that?
Or about ourselves. Because I've had clients who can't come up with three positive things about themselves. And I have to say they're usually women. And they have to go and ask their partners or their sons or their daughters or whoever. So that is a resource if you're not sure of the positive things about yourself. Now, you and I think, could reel off a whole pile of positive things about ourselves.
On a good day.
And I wouldn't have done that when I was 20.
No.
I might have done it a bit when I was 40, but I can do it now because I know the things I've struggled with and I still struggle with, and I'm not minimising those. But thinking about those, really isn't that helpful now?
I think that's the thing. And it does come down to, I've done this as an exercise with clients of write down all of those things that their negative voice says to them. And then we go through them. They don't even have to tell me what they say. They just spend a few minutes writing them down. And then it's like, okay, I mean, this is an exercise anyone feel free to do to yourself at home. You know, write down all of those things that the negative voice says and then look at them and cross out any of them that you couldn't prove in a court of law.
Yes. Yes, I like that.
To be true, you have to have hardcore evidence.
Yes.
You know,
yes,
so if you say, you know, if I said, I'm stupid, well, is there evidence? Well, you know, I do have a degree and I do, you know, and all of those sorts of things. So actually,
deputy head teachers generally aren't stupid. Yeah.
Yes. You know, I have to cross that out. Sometimes do I feel stupid?
Oh,
yes.
Different.
That's different.
Different.
But am I stupid? No.
No.
So it's those sorts of things. And generally speaking, after that, people have crossed out sometimes all,
yes,
but generally over half of those things. And then the next question I ask them is, which ones there are helpful? And again, most of them that are left are not helpful. They just make you feel stressed. They just make you feel bad about yourself.
Confidence, reduction, everything.
Absolutely. So it's then about, okay, are there any here that you can make your peace with? Or sort of go, actually, I say that as a bad thing, but I'm fine with it. It's just, it was always said to me. So I'm quite clumsy. And as a child, it was always sort of like, oh my goodness, she could fall over her own feet, this one. So to me, yeah, and Nikki's nodding.
Not about you, about me.
Yes, yes, about you, yeah. Clumsiness is a criticism. You are clumsy, that's a bad thing.
Yes.
Is there evidence? Well, unfortunately, yes, there is evidence that I'm still quite clumsy.
But your ADHD, hello, it goes to the territory.
But also, is it a bad thing? Is it the end of the world? No, it's just part of who I am. Does it really affect my life? Particularly, not really. I wish I didn't drop things. I get a bit frustrated at the times that I'm clumsy. I have poor fine motor skills, but hey ho. So therefore, I can take it off my negative self-talk.
Yeah.
And it just is neutralized.
And there are things that balance it as well. So as we know, we both have fantastic senses of direction. Yeah, and we know where we are at any given point and how to get from A to B with no problem whatsoever.
Yeah.
I am rubbish.
Yes.
It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
It's fine.
You've neutralised it.
Because I've found workarounds.
Yes.
We take photos, don't we? We've said this.
Yes, where our cars are.
Where our cars are. And thank you. Thank you, Apple iPhone.
Yes.
One day, literally, I would not have known where it was.
Yes.
I just rushed off to some appointment, parked somewhere, God knows where it was, on the outskirts of London. Da-da-da-da. Came out of the appointment, thought, oh my God, where the hell is the car? I had no idea. And then I suddenly thought, resourcefulness, I suddenly thought, I wonder if that thing I've read about is on my phone. And it was. And it took me back to the car.
Yeah.
And it was like, thank you. Because I literally didn't know where it was.
Yeah.
Not a clue.
But what you've done there is take something that could be a burrito.
A burrito.
Oh, you're so stupid. You're so and everything else.
Yeah.
You've accepted that about yourself and you do something about it. And sometimes it can be annoying and...
Couldn't find my way out of a paper bag.
Yeah. Sometimes it can be annoying, but you've taken it off the negative self-talk Bliss, you've yeah. neutralised it.
And the biggest joke of all this was I was a dispatch rider for 2.5 years.
Yeah, wow.
So, ironically, I could find my way around London quite well by the end of it, but could I remember where the car was? No.
different parts of memory.
Yeah. And I think that's it. It takes the power out of those things. If you know what your negative self-talk says, do you recognise that it's, I think we often think it's true. We accept it as being,
yes.
you know, this, whether it's, you call it a passenger on your bus or whatever.
I like that, yeah.
But we think that they're an authority.
Yeah.
And actually, as the bus driver, we have the control and we have the power to go. And in fact, what's her name? Elizabeth Gilbert. She wrote a really lovely book about something magic. Can't think what it's called.
Big Magic.
Big Magic.
About creativity.
That's right.
Wonderful.
Yes. And she says in the beginning about she was planning to write a book and she said, but her negative self-talk popped up with all of this. Oh, you'll be rubbish. No one will want to read it. Blah, 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 blah. So she said she wrote a letter to her critical self,
yes.
which was basically along the lines of, okay, thanks ever so much for piping up.
Mm.
I know that you're worried about me and all this, but I've got this
yes.
and you can stay on this journey, you know, because I know you're not going to go anywhere. I know you're going to keep chipping in, but actually I'm in control.
Absolutely.
You don't get to choose where we go. You don't even touch the radio. No, I'm in control of this. And I think that's the thing. It's taking back the control. It's taking the power out of the negative.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think it's really important to say if you have a recognised mental health condition, that is not what we're talking about.
No,
here.
We're talking about the, if you like, commoner garden. Everybody has it.
Yes.
ADHDs may have it more, I suspect.
Yes.
As I said at the beginning, but it's that.
It's
what's
yes.
going round in our head all the time at any given point.
Yes. And clearly, if you are somebody who experiences a mental health condition, that's not relevant.
No.
That's a very different factor. And you can't just, you know, address it or switch it off. And
no.
I don't want anybody to think that we are minimising the impact of mental health conditions.
Yeah.
So it is within this context of the usual shared experience that people have.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's being able to notice and then to choose to address it and call it out for what it is and stop believing that that voice is true.
Absolutely. And to question it, be curious, as we are in these conversations.
Yeah.
Curiosity is one of our best tools, I think.
Yes.
If anybody wants to go and learn more about what Professor Cross was talking about, you can go off and listen to all the tools that he mentions, so I don't need to cover them here. But one of the things he talks about is, apart from journaling, is distanced self-talk. And it's stepping outside yourself because we get caught up. What happens is we get entangled in that voice and we don't even know that it's the voice talking to us.
Mm.
And so if we get that little glimmer, that little light through the slightly open door, shining out that there's something going on and we're doing something less than helpful to ourselves, if we can step outside that, and even if we use the third person, okay, Nikki, right, okay, what's going on here? Because we're, as he says, we're better at giving advice to others than to ourselves.
Mm.
And apparently this is known as Solomon's paradox, because Solomon was very wise, but he made some terrible decisions himself. So if we can step outside ourselves, okay, so I was having some problems with somebody in my family and I decided to do an exercise that we learned on our course, the coaching course, where you take 4 bits of paper and you write a word on each one, and each one is a second strength. So it's not an obvious strength for you. It's something that you have evidence for that you can do, but it's not the first thing that comes to mind. So I had... I can't remember the other two, but one was focus and one was patience. Mm-hmm. And we had to put them on the floor and then our coach, we swapped around. And the person who was coaching us said, think of the problem. So I was thinking of this person and the communication problems and the rows we were having. And I stepped onto one of these 4 words. I just stepped onto patience. And instantly I was up in the corner of the room in my studio, looking down at myself, working as a graphic designer. Have I said this before?
No.
Okay. So I was looking down at myself as a graphic designer, working away with endless patience. If it was the thrill of the chase, I could feel something coming that, the design was, it was going to suddenly make sense. And I could feel it getting warmer and warmer. And you know what? It's exactly the same with coaching.
Mm.
When you get your antennas start waggling, don't they? And you think, there's a thread here. We can pull that and just, where are we going? Oh, it's exciting. And I have endless patience when the client's talking and you just want to help them draw out, or you just sit and listen or whatever happens to me. And so the next time I was talking to this person, I went up into the corner of the room and was looking down at myself. And I was totally different. And I was so patient. And guess what? They changed. They had no idea this was going on.
Mm-hmm.
It was just that ability to step outside myself and view myself from the top room looking down. Now, I'm very visual and not everybody could do that necessarily. But
I don't think I could do that. Yes.
But their own version of distancing, stepping outside yourself in some fashion, how would that work for you? Could you see a way that would work?
I think I would have to sort of do it verbally. I don't know, maybe it is slightly visual.
Can you see the back of your head at the moment in the chair?
No, I really struggle with those sorts of things.
Oh, okay. A lot of people can't. Yes. So, you know, I'm a designer, so I'm meant to be able to do this stuff.
No,
so.
We did an exercise when we were training, didn't when you, or is it in the NLP training when you sort of standing behind and then standing behind the one standing behind and so on. And I was just like, I can't do that.
Well, we each have our areas of strength.
Yeah, I think for me, it's more cognitive than that. It's just thinking it through and thinking of their perspective on things and what might be going on for them.
Yes.
And I'm not always very good at doing that, I think.
But are you good at it sometimes?
Yeah, I can do it. Yes, I don't think it doesn't come naturally to me at all. You're always on. You're always on duty.
I know. I'm just a coach. I can't help it. What can I say? Bloody annoying, aren't I? Shut up, Nikki.
Sometimes I just want to let me be shit at something, Nikki.
All right, be shit at it then.
No, I'm only joking.
I know.
I think there are some people I find it easier, as we all do, to be more compassionate to than others and see their perspective from. But I think this has been really, really interesting. Well, I found it really interesting. I hope other people do as well.
Yes.
I think it has opened up that you've given a lot of information. Yeah, there's a lot of food for thought there. But I think it does come down to what you've just said about recognizing it, noticing it, challenging it. Finding alternatives. Oh my gosh, it comes back to pause again, doesn't it?
It does. Can I just say one more thing? I've just looked at my notes and so on. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, and it was linked with a breakup that I had in the past, and I was going down an emotional spiral, and it wasn't so much that I was beating myself up. It was sadness and grief, basically. But I think this could be useful. It's a transferable skill, and we each have our own version of this, perhaps, a bit like I've just said about going in the corner of the room. I could feel myself going down this rumination, and it could be the critical parent, it could be the inner voice, it could be anything. And I could feel myself just going down and into negative thoughts. And I suddenly saw this spiral in my head. And this is, again, visual. I've got two options here. This spiral going down and down, and it was kind of like it was made of green iron filings. So it's kind of furry. And it was just getting darker as it went down. And I realised I was going down this spiral. So I thought, well, if I'm going down, I can stop it and come back up again. So it's a bit like turning an oil tanker around. It took a while, but I've watched it and it was actually sort of DIY mindfulness. So I made myself concentrate on this spiral. It's like I had a little ball going down the spiral. And then I'm helpfully showing you as I do. So I eventually made it stop after a couple of minutes, slow down and then stop, and then brought it back. And it interrupted my thought pattern. And by the time I got back to the top of the spiral, I wouldn't say I felt great, but I felt I'd interrupted that rumination and that going on and on and on and on and on and on. And I can see how that could be useful. The other thing was to find something in your life that is a line in the sand. And as I said to you, there's a few episodes in my life that have been lines in the sand where before and after. And if there's a positive experience that you can find that illustrates to you how useless it is following all this negative voice. When I moved here, I moved from this idyllic place with fields around it and everything, and it was beautiful. And when Cats Protection came to vet me to see if I could have a cat from them, a rescue cat, they went, oh my God, this is an amazing place for a cat to come. And anyway, so then I moved to a house that's on an estate, as you know, and it's fine, but it's just a little box on an estate. And for 9 months, when I knew I had to move, I was desperate not to make my poor little cat move from this beautiful place. I adored my cat and tortured myself absolutely in floods of tears on the day of moving. I couldn't believe I had to do this to this poor animal. I was berating myself for putting her through all this. I brought her here. She loves it here. Absolutely loved it here. Loves it to bits. It was small. It was safe. She obviously felt threatened by all the open fields and the foxes or whatever. I don't know. So I'd built up this thing in my head about how idyllic her life was. Well, obviously it wasn't, because when she came here, suddenly it was. And not only was I a bit wrong, I was 180 degrees wrong. I could not have been more wrong. And I tortured myself every day for 9 months about this. Mm. And her name was Pebbles, and she died last year, bless her. And whenever I find myself going either down that spiral or into that ruminative beating myself up thing, I just think Pebbles, and it stops me in my tracks, because I am not going there anymore.
No, no. That's a really good backup to the, is that thinking true and helpful?
Yes, yes.
I heard somebody talking about the analogy of a TV remote control and said, you know, our brains are like the TV and all this information sort of comes on the screen, but we can change it. We are in control of the remote control. So if we don't like what's on the screen, we can reach for the remote control and turn it over.
Actually, literally in our hands.
Literally. Yeah. Get the control and turn it over. And that our brains are quite similar to that. But it is about learning to say, I don't want to really watch this program.
Yes.
Because I don't really like it and it's not helping me. And choosing to look at something else and turning the channel.
Ah, so that fits. That's a way of distancing. So it's a distancing self. So what I was talking about is that awareness. Firstly, you've got to be aware that this is happening.
Yes.
Rather than just being in it. You have to be able to spot it, notice the feelings, maybe notice what's going on in your body, be aware of it. If you're feeling shit, just feel like your body what's going on.
Yeah.
Then reach for the remote. I really like that.
And it's that, what are those feelings doing to my thinking and therefore my actions?
Exactly.
You know, because sometimes we're thinking, oh, this is all going to be awful. This is going to be terrible. So then we feel crap. So we act in a way that we don't do something that maybe we would like to do. You know, we don't go to a party because we've been thinking, oh, everyone there hates me. So we feel really depressed. So we don't go to the party. You notice that's going on and you reach the remote and change kind of go, or, you know, it's that alternative view. Actually, you know, Nikki will be there and she likes me and we can have a chat. Or, and I think there's another point. What can I do? What action can I take? Could I send Nikki a text and say, oh, I'm feeling a bit nervous about going to this party. Is it all right if I hang out with you for a bit?
Mm.
We can do something sometimes that helps us get over it.
Absolutely. And also, just to wrap up, if I may.
Yes.
This is groany coaching territory, but hey ho. If we think we can't, we can't. If we think we can, we may well be able to do it. We can.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I think that if we think we can, we can. Obviously, I'm not going to be an astronaut tomorrow.
Yeah.
But, well, as far as I know, unless I'm shot out of a cannon somehow. I mean, both of us do things in our life. You know, you just run a marathon. I've done all sorts of things as well. And it's like, because we think we might be able to, we try it.
Mm.
But if you allow your brain, if you hide the remote somewhere in a drawer upstairs and never reach for it,
yes,
then you're just reducing the amount of options in your life and your capacity. And the more you do, the more you're able to do. It's just one of those classic truisms, isn't it?
Mm. But that saying, at times, especially for people who are rejection sensitive or struggle with emotional regulation or have anxiety, it can feel flooring, can't it?
Yes, totally.
Yes.
Okay, so you and I have both had circumstances like that.
Yes, yeah.
We're not setting ourselves up as some paragon of virtue here or
God, no.
That we've never had problems. That's the whole point. Of.
Let's be honest, Nikki. People we know listen to this and they both know that that's shit.
The horrible truth.
We can get away with pretending to be that.
Yes. Even now, with all this experience and all this training, we still do. Yeah. No, but that's the point. It's a struggle. It's not easy.
And it's not a, you know, yes, okay, you and I both know to reach the remote control, but it's quite a faulty remote control that often defaults back to the old channel.
Yeah, and some buggers take the batteries out.
Yes. Oh, this has been really good. It's been, I've really enjoyed chatting to you.
Yeah, me too.
That's given me a lot of food for thought as well. So,
yeah, well, likewise, I shall be using the bus thing. I think that's really helpful with explaining IFS to people. So thank you for that.
Ah, no, that was good.
And I like the remote. So as ever, we've swapped. And
yes,
swapsies.
Perfect.
All right, lovely. Looking forward to next time.
Brilliant. Good to speak to you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for joining us on our ADHD journey. If you can spare a sec, a review or ranking would be hugely appreciated by us. 5 stars would be marvellous, but whatever you think. Every single one really does help. As well as on your favourite app, you can find us on YouTube and Instagram at the ADHD Connection _podcast. So we hope to see you on there. Thanks again for listening, and bye for now.